Mr. Yevtushenko, who has just arrived from the Soviet Union, has telephoned to say, and I quote, this is addressed to Ms. Moore and Mr. Auden, "I regret that I can't be at your reading. I envy your listeners in whose presence poetry's quiet miracle will be achieved." Marianne Moore will next year be 80. W. H. Auden will be 60. They have both so altered the course of the poetry of this century that it is impossible to think of modern poetry without them. They have often paid tribute to each other. It is fitting that we have this opportunity to pay tribute to them both. Ms. Moore has called W. H. Auden a master. Mr. Auden has admitted, with his characteristic candor, that he has stolen from Ms. Moore more treasure than he can accurately assess. The treasure that other poets, including myself, have stolen from them both over many years can never be weighed or cataloged. Reading them together, one discovers how very much on the same wavelength they are. W. H. Auden's first loves were machinery and mines. He wanted to be a mining engineer. Marianne Moore has also always been interested in machinery. In her most recent book, she addresses herself to granite and steel, to the catenary curve of the cables of Brooklyn Bridge. Such interest reflects the fact that in poetry, they are both conscious artists striving to be explicit, to make their meaning clear. The objective, as Ms. Moore puts it, is architecture, not demolition. They are accurate and careful observers of the modern scene, and the range of their interest is phenomenal. If I ask myself what single piece of literature gave me greatest pleasure in 1961, Mr. Auden wrote, it was an article in the Scientific American called Cleaning Shrimps. And what are worthy ends, asked Miss Moore, knowledge made possible by an overpowering desire to possess it, usefulness like that of Dr. Squibb, whose pure ether and reliable ether mask were, for use by all who needed them, never patented, conjoining bone and nerve ends to a boy's severed arm, small, if small, ingenuities. One would like to have invented the zipper fastener, epoxy glue, the collapsible dustpan, figure eight stitch closure of the hide cover of the baseball. As critics, whether in poetry or prose, their aim is understanding and appreciation. Attacking bad books is not only a waste of time, says Mr. Auden, but bad for the character. I've been accused of substituting appreciation for criticism, and justly, says Miss Moore, since there's nothing I dislike more than the exposé or any kind of revenge. Neither Miss Moore nor Mr. Auden has ever been a part of the avant-garde. They haven't had to. They are traditionalists who remind us constantly of our greatest traditions. They are both counter-revolutionary in the sense that Mr. Auden applied the term to de Tocqueville. That is, one who has no wish to return to the condition which preceded revolution. The body, he said, knows nothing of freedom, only of necessities. These are the same for all bodies. And insofar as we are bodies, we are revolutionaries. Insofar, however, as we are also souls and minds, we are, or ought to be, counter-revolutionaries. When Louise Bogen says of Marianne Moore that she does not resemble certain 17th century writers, she might be one of them. She could also be speaking of W. H. Auden, for he, like Marianne Moore, is that nearly pure example of that inquisitive, receptive kind of civilized human being which began to flourish during the High Renaissance, the disciple of the new as opposed to the old learning, the connoisseur, the human scholar, humane scholar, to whom nothing was alien and for whom man was the measure of all. Miss Moore will read first this evening, and after she will read for 10 minutes, and after that time Mr. Auden will read for 20 minutes, and Miss Moore will return at the end. Now, in presenting Miss Moore, I will use her own method of quotation, and I quote from W. H. Auden, who says that he saw from the first in reading her that she was pure Alice. She has all the Alice qualities, the distaste for noise and excess, the fastidiousness, the love of order and precision, the astringent, ironical sharpness. Like Lawrence's, many of Miss Moore's best poems are, overtly at least, about animals. But unlike Lawrence, she likes the human race. For all the evil he does, man is, for her, a more sacred being than an animal. The approach of her poetry is that of a naturalist, but really, their theme is always the good life. And now, if I may be permitted a personal quotation, in a poem I wrote for Miss Moore's 77th birthday, I spoke of an indigo bunting observed on a midsummer day in Vermont, resting within the gray cushions of heat, his blue turning in the half-hooded light from indigo to ultramarine to azure, and concluded, addressing Miss Moore, "See him as you would see him, this New England visitor from the coast of Cuba, this indigo bunting as more than a mere jewel, as a flame breathing at the core of consciousness, fed by conscience, a poem poised against the shifting, dull, gray seasons, asking in its permanence and rare felicity, what are years?" The phrase permanence and rare felicity is Miss Moore's, and I'm happy to return it to her this evening where it properly belongs. I stole it too. As one who has not only imagined excellence, but has made it, and made it for all time, Marianne Moore, in the integrity of her work and in her great and exquisite achievement, represents for all of us a permanence, a rare felicity. Miss Marianne Moore.
This place, this audience, and this speaker is about to come in on, Mr. Auden. I'm going to read my porcupine piece about humility and modesty and no greed. His shield, it is called, the pinswin, or spine swine. Edgehog, miscalled hedgehog, with all his edges out, echidna and echinoderm, in distressed pincushion, thorn fur coats, the spiny pig, or porcupine, the rhino, with horned snout, everything is battle-dressed. As for syllabic verse, just notice, snout, rises out and dressed with something else. They're all right. Pig fur won't do. I'll wrap myself in salamander skin, like Prester John, a lizard in the midst of flames, a firebrand that is life, asbestos-eyed, asbestos-eared, without tattooed nap, and permanent pig on the instep. I discovered that certain sailors have a pig tattooed on one instep as a charm against drowning. In his unconquerable country of unpompous gusto, gold was so common, none considered it. Greed and flattery were unknown. Though rubies large as tennis balls, conjoined in streams so that the mountain seemed to bleed, the unextinguishable salamander styled himself but presbyter. His shield was his humility. He revealed a formula safer than an armorer's. The power of relinquishing what you would keep, that is freedom. Become dinosaur skulled, quill, or salamander wooled, more iron shod and javelin dressed than a hedgehog battalion of steel. Beady doll, don't be envied, don't envy, or be more armed with a measuring rod. Then a face. I am not treacherous, callous, jealous, superstitious, supercilious, venomous, or absolutely hideous. Studying its expression, exasperated desperation, though at no real impasse, would gladly break the glass, the mirror, when love of order, ardor, unsecureless simplicity are all one needs to be. Certain faces, a few, one or two, or one face photographed by recollection to my mind, to my sight, must remain a delight. Is that 10 minutes? I have another. This is a dream I was supposed to have had about J.S. Bach. Jerome Shipman afforded me this fantasy. Well, it's about artists in residence, pianists, sculptors, painters. So they very nearly equal the student body in number. The committee, formed to do but one thing, discover positions for artists, was worried and happy, rejoiced to have magnetized Bach and his family to Northwestern in quotations, not college. University. besides 5 harpsichords without which he would not leave home. For his methodic, unmetronomic, melodic diversity, contrapuntally appointedly, persistently, irresistibly fate-like bard, finely words, expected to create for university occasions inventions with wing was no problem. After stiff master classes in Germany, stiffer in Germany, each week a cantata, chorales, fugues, concerti. Here in America, students craved a teacher, and each student worked jubilation, rejoicings, felicity, repeated fugue-like, all of it to infinity. Note, too, that overworked Bach was not irked. Haydn, when he heard of Bach's billowing sail, begged Prince Esterhazy to lend him to Yale. Master mode, expert fugal forms since then prevail. Dazzling nonsense, I dreamed, I imagine it. Not enough. J. Sebastian, born at Eisenach, has its coat of arms in my dream. Bach plays Bach. Coming out.
There have been innumerable tributes to Mr. Auden as the greatest moral poetic spokesman of our time from younger poets. I should like to read just one, a poem to W. H. Auden on his 50th birthday by Barbara Howes, because it seems to me to say so precisely what all of us would like to say to him on the eve of his 60th. To W. H. Auden on his 50th birthday. Books collide are books in a library do. Marlowe by Charlotte Mew, Sir Horace Walpole by Hugh. The most unlikely writers stand shoulder to shoulder. One studies incongruity as one grows older. Symbols collide, signs of the zodiac range the celestial track. Piscis has now swung back into the lead. We learn to recognize each fleck for what it is in our mackerel skies. Ideas collide, as words in a poem can. The poet, Promethean, strikes fire in a single line. Form glows in the far reaches of his brain. Poets who travel will come home again. Feeling collides. Lying for years in wait, may grope or hesitate. Now let us celebrate feeling, ideas, symbols, books which can meet with greatness here within one man. Mr. W. H. Auden.
As I think Mr. Smith told you, ladies and gentlemen, I will read in the middle and then we'll have the pleasure of having Miss Moore back. I thought I'd start off with two poems which are related in subject, because they're connected with similar incidents, one in the Iliad, one in the Aeneid. You remember that in the Iliad, Thetis, the mother of the hero Achilles, goes to Hephaestus, the smith of the gods, and asks him to make a shield for her son, which he does. And on it, Hephaestus puts all the most sort of beautiful sights you can see on earth. In the Aeneid, the mother of Aeneas also goes to Vulcan, the Roman smith of the gods, and asks him to make a shield, which he does. And on it, he puts the future history of the Roman people up till the time when Augustus becomes emperor. All right, in his first poem, The Shield of Achilles, all you have to remember is that she means Thetis and he means Hephaestus. She looked over his shoulder for vines and olive trees, marble well-governed cities and ships upon untamed seas. But there on the shining metal his hands had put instead an artificial wilderness and a sky like lead. A plain without a feature, bare and brown, no blade of grass, no sign of neighbourhood, nothing to eat and nowhere to sit down. Yet, congregated on its blankness, stood an unintelligible multitude, a million eyes, a million boots in line, without expression, waiting for a sign. Out of the air, a voice without a face, proved by statistics that some cause was just, in tones as dry and level as the place. No one was cheered, and nothing was discussed. Column by column in a cloud of dust, they marched away, enduring a belief whose logic brought them somewhere else to grief. She looked over his shoulder for ritual pieties, white flower-garlanded heifers, libation and sacrifice. But there on the shining metal where the altar should have been, she saw by his flickering forge-light quite another scene. Barbed wire enclosed an arbitrary spot where bored officials lounged, one cracked a joke, and sentries sweated, for the day was hot. A crowd of ordinary, decent folk watched from without, and neither moved nor spoke, as three pale figures were led forth and bound to three posts driven upright in the ground. The mass and majesty of this world, all that carries weight and always weighs the same, lay in the hands of others. They were small and could not hope for help, and no help came. What their foes liked to do was done. Their shame was all the worst could wish. They lost their pride and died as men before their bodies died. She looked over his shoulder for athletes at their games, men and women in a dance moving their sweet limbs quick, quick to music. But there on the shining shield, his hands had set no dancing thaw, but a weed-choked field. A ragged urchin, aimless and alone, loitered about that vacancy. A bird flew up to safety from his well-aimed stone. That girls are raped, that two boys knife a third, were axioms to him, who had never heard of any world where promises were kept, or one could weep because another wept. The thin-lipped armourer, Hephaestus, hobbled away. Thetis, the shining breasts, cried out in dismay at what the god had wrought to please her son, the strong, iron-hearted, man-slaying Achilles, who would not live long. The second is lighter in tone, but really just as gloomy. This is about the shield made for Aeneas. And here is one fact perhaps I should remind you of, that the last emperor in the West was a Catholic, was christened after, he was christened Romulus Augustulus, and was, as you will see in the poem, who he is deposed by. No, Virgil, no. Not even the first of the Romans can learn his Roman history in the future tense. Not even to serve your political turn. Hindsight as foresight makes no sense. How was your shield-making god to explain why his masterpiece, his grand panorama of scenes from the coming historical drama of an unborn nation, war after war, all the birthdays needed to preordain the Octavius the world was waiting for, should so abruptly and mysteriously stop? What cause could he show why he didn't foresee the future beyond 31 BC? Why a curtain of darkness should finally drop on Carians, Marini, Gelonians with quivers, converging Romeward in abject file, Euphrates, Araxes, and similar rivers, learning to flow in a Latinate style, and Caesar be left where prophecy ends, inspecting troops and gifts forever. Wouldn't Aeneas have asked, what next? After such triumph, what portends? As rhetoric, your device was too clever. It lets us imagine a continuation to your eighth book, an interpolation scrawled on the side of a tattered text in a decadent script, the composition of a down-at-heels refugee rhetorician with an empty belly seeking employment, cooked up in haste for the drunken enjoyment of some blonde princeling whom Lute had inclined to believe that Providence had assigned to blondes the task of improving mankind. Open quotes. Now Mainz appears on starry New Year's Eve, as two-horned Rhine throws off the Latin yoke to bear the Vandal on his frozen back. Lo, Danube, now congenial to the Goth, news not unwelcome to Teutonic shades, and all lamenting beyond Acheron, demolished Carthage, or a plundered Greece. And now Juturna leaves the riverbed of her embittered grievance. Loud her song, immoderate her joy, for word has come of treachery at the Salarian gate. Alaric has avenged Turnus. End of quote. No, Virgil, no. Behind your verse so masterfully made, we hear the weeping of a muse betrayed. Your Anchises isn't convincing at all. It's asking too much of us to be told, a shade so long-sighted, a father who knows that Romulus will build a wall, Augustus found an age of gold, and is trying to teach a dutiful son the love of what will be in the long run. Should mention them both, but not disclose. Surely no prophet could afford to miss. No man of destiny failed to enjoy so clear a proof of providence as this. The names predestined for the Catholic boy whom Arian or Devaca will depose. Well, in here, then, 2 points. The first one is called River Profile. There's a quotation, an epigraph, actually, beginning from Novalis, "Our body is a molded river." Out of a bellicose foretime, thundering head-on collisions of cloud and rock in an upthrust, crevasse and avalanche troll country, deadly to breathers, it whelms into our picture below the melt line, where tarns lie frore under frowning cirques, goat bill, windbreaker, fishing rod, miner's lamp country. Already at ease with the mean and gestures that become its kindness, in streams still anonymous, still jumpable, flows as it should through any declining country in probing spirals. Soon of a size to be named and the cause of dirty infighting among rival agencies, down a steep stair, penstock and turbine country, it plunges Ramsdam. To foam through a corkscrew gorge incised in softer strata, hemmed between crags that mantle heaven, robber castle, tow rope, portageway country, nightmare of merchants. Disemboging from foothills, now in hushed meanders, now in riffling braids, it vaunts across a senile plain, well entered, shadow and side oppressed country. Its regal progress, gallanted for a while by quibbling poplars, then by chimneys. Led off to cool and launder, retort, steam hammer, gasometer country, it changes colour. Polluted, bridged by girders, banked with concrete, now it bisects a polyglot metropolis. Ticket tape, taxi, brothel, footlights country, a la mod always. Broadening or burrowing to the moon's phases, turbid with pulverized waste mantle, on through flatter, duller, hotter cotton gin country, it scours approaching the tidal mark where it puts off majesty, disintegrates and through swamps of a delta, punting pole, fowling piece, oyster tongues country, wearies to its final act of surrender, effacement, atonement, in a huge amorphous aggregate, no cuddled, attractive child ever dreams of, non-country. Image of death as a spherical dewdrop of life. Unlovely monsters, our tales believe, can be translated too, even as water, the selfless mother of all especials. Then I'll finish with a poem which is really about saints. It's called Insignificant Elephants, and the reason for this is that there's a passage in one of the medieval bestiaries when it's dealing with elephants, occurs the following sentence. Our Lord Jesus Christ, although he was the greatest, was made the most insignificant of all the elephants. Talented creatures on the defensive because glory, real estate, girls are not in virtue's gift. Translate into verse or prose. Do equally well in tragic and comic parts. Give storytellers the nudge to invent that cooks get from slightly tainted meat. But a Hugh of Lincoln or a Peter Claver are only game for reporters. News, like Auschwitz, Dickens could not have made up, nor Halley have predicted. Genetic typos produce infant prodigies, genetic typos bring forth infant prodigies, imbeciles, midgets, but no prime numbers, no saints. Nor would a snapshot reveal a halo. They hide their incandescence like tasty moths who mimic unpalatable cousins. Wild converts at sea on a collapsing culture concocted one or two viable folk tales. George cut a dash with his dragon, but a deal of bosh, magical hanky-panky where spurious cults could mushroom. There never was a Catherine with a wheel, nor a Barbara to bless the artillery, nor an uncumber for English wives to invoke against troublesome husbands. anecdotes, even from those dark years, have reached us that are odd enough to be true. Perpetua, with a beastly end to face, trying to convince. Papa, if that is a jug, then I am a Christian. And dreaming of a shepherd who consoled her with cream cheese. With all our flair for research, we are still nonplussed. What shifted members of our species to become insignificant elephants? A hard life, often a hard death, and side effects which a humanist finds hard to stomach are signs that divulge nothing. A trait which might cannot project on. All who met them speak of a joy which made their own conveniences, mournfulness, and a bad smell. If their hunch was not mistaken, it would explain why there's something fishy about a high style and the characters it suits. Why we add the embarrassing prefix super to a natural life which nothing prevents us living except our natures. Thank you.
This is pretty light entertainment after this real poetry of Mr. Arndt. Mr. Gasset, Ortega Gasset, is saying that nobility must be synonymous with action. And he feels, and this interested me, the listlessness and apathy on the part of our young people and others who mob us and create chaos and destroy churches and stone cars and trains. Certainly in any artistic endeavor, such as writing or any scholastic effort, can't have any listlessness. When Lord Burkitt was asked by, I think it was John Freeman, why he left a profitable and relatively interesting profession, working in a draper's shop with his father, he said very quietly, for the fascination of saying things in a way that is effective. Well, La Fontaine made that point over and over again. If you wish people to listen to you, you have to fascinate them. I'm going to read his line in love. Before the speech was obstructed, lions, and such as were attracted to young girls, sought an alliance. Why not? Since as paragons or puissants, there were at that time, knightly fellows of metal and intelligence, adorned by manes like halos. The point of the preamble follows. A lion, one in the multitude, met in the meadow as he fared a shepherdess for whom he cared. He sought to win her if he could, though the father would have preferred a less ferocious son-in-law. To consent undoubtedly was hard. Fear meant that the alternate was barred, moreover, refused, and he foresaw that some fine day the two might explain clandestine marriage, as the chain that fettered the last, bewitched beyond cure by fashions conducive to hauteur, and the fancy that shaggy shoulder fur made her willful lover handsomer. But it doesn't. The father, with despair choked down, said, though of heart constrained to frown, "The child is a dainty one. Better wait. You might let your claw points scratch her when your heavy forepaws touch her. You could, if not too importunate, have your claws clipped, and there in front see that your teeth are filed blunt, because a kiss might be enjoyed by you the more, I should think, if my daughter were not annoyed, because forced to shrink, because improvidently annoyed." The enthralled animal mellowed. His mind's eye, having been shuttered, without teeth or claws, it followed. Dogs were loosed. Defenses were gone. The consequence was slight resistance. Ah, love, ah, love, when you're set knots drawn, one can but say farewell, good sense. Then, I have a natural objection to cliches. Although Mr. Saintsbury said there are many worse things than a cliche. Avoid excess such as adore and bore. I am, by the word, bored. I refuse to use divine to mean something pleasing, terrific color of some horror. I refuse to use enchant, dement, even frightful plight, however justified, or frivolous fool, however suitable. I've escaped? No. Still trapped by these word diseases. Have no pauses. The phrases lack lyric force. Sound capric, like Attic, Archaic, or Freak, Calico Greek. This is not verse, of course, but I'm sure of this. Nothing mundane is divine. Nothing divine is mundane.
We'll have a break now, and the questions on the white cards will be collected, and if you have questions, Ms. Moore, Mr. Auden will be happy, if they can, to answer them.
I'm sorry to say that although many of you have requested individual poems to be read by Miss Moore and Mr. Auden. They really cannot read any more this evening, and I think you can understand that. Many have asked for Miss Moore's new poem, Tell Me, Tell Me, which is very beautiful, and Mr. Moore's elegy on the death of William Butler Yeats, which has become a classic. But we
bore the pants off me.
But we must get to the questions, and I'm going to read the first one, which is addressed to Miss Moore, addressed to both, but I'm going to address it to Miss Moore first. Many contemporary poets seem to be using what William Carlos Williams called the variable foot. Is this device of versification rhythmical at all, or arbitrary and unimpassioned?
Rising your rock, Miss Moore.
It depends on how impassioned the person is. That's all.
Mr. Auden?
I haven't the faintest idea what a variable foot is.
Now, which is there one you would like? Well, this is addressed to Miss Moore. Has your change of address affected your muse in any way? Miss Moore has moved into Manhattan from Brooklyn.
So I have no time to see about that. Do you have any opinion about that? I'm just the way I was before I came.
Mr. Auden, may I ask?
It is Benjamin Britten, I believe, who put your poem, I cannot grow, I have no shadow to run away from, I only play poem to music. How did you feel when you heard the music? Did it seem to realize your intent?
Well, the particular quotation is the middle section of a piece called Song for St. Cecilia's Day, which was written expressly before Mr. Britten to set. It was written to be set to music, and I was very happy with the result.
Well, this is a very direct question to Miss Moore, and I should read it, but we're going to pass it over. May I have your hat?
No, I need it. I need it. This lily pad.
Another to Miss Moore. Thanks for all the wonderful poetry, but what happened to Sandy Koufax?
Well, the Viking Press has a whole book about him, and I'm waiting to read that and intensify my likes or reservations.
In the latest edition of September 1, 1939, you have omitted a line I like.
We must love one another or die.
We must love one another or die. Why?
Well, the latest edition will be shortly appearing. The poem doesn't appear at all. because I think it's a thoroughly dishonest poem, which I'm ashamed of having written. I tried to mend it, but with no results. Now, you see, what is wrong with the line, we must love one another or die, is we have to die anyway.
Miss Moore, you have lived in New York for so long. Are you able to find real toads in gardens here?
Naturally, gardens.
Lots of them. Quartz toad that is a little piece of statuary. The little.
This is a very calculated question. Mr. Auden understands very well what it means. What is your relationship to Middle Earth?
Well, I presume this is a question from a fellow Tolkien fan, because in The Lord of the Rings, it's a word that, of course, it has in medieval literature. I assume that this is raised at all because by somebody who is a Tolkien fan. Well, of course, like everyone else, all of us here, we are members of Middle Earth. If the question is, so I don't know what our relationship is to it, except we live there. If the question is, do I like the Tolkien, the answer is obviously yes. But I don't know what else.
We'll go on a little more.
Now, I can't make out what my relationship to Middle Earth can be, except what it is for all of us, that we're human beings who live here. And we're glad to be alive. I don't know what else one says. But if the question's about what do I think of The Lord of the Rings, which I claim to be an expert on, of course I admire it very much. There are certain things wrong with it. All the women are dreadful. You know, they're all pre-Raphaelite. The only one who's nice fair is the spider. But this is something else.
This is not a question addressed to Miss Moore, but a statement. And I think I should read it. You are all that is good in America, the best in American spirit, an admirer.
Did that we all agree? Mysterious question.
A mysterious question. Mr. Auden, it has been said that Gide's work has had an influence on your development. What is the lasting significance of Gide today?
Well, first of all, I can only say that Gide has had no influence on me whatever. I did once have to show him around Berlin, and I'm not going to go into all that. Except that he was terribly mean about money. His significance, that is for you to decide, for each one of us to decide for ourselves. While I'm at it now, deal with simply a factual question. Somebody asked me about where can one obtain a copy of a translation? Well, it's not by me only, it's by Mr. Joseph Goldmeister, of Mahagonishtat of Werther Brecht. Alas, it isn't obtainable anywhere. It's a manuscript, and I think I've lost the last page.
What do you mean with the other?
No. What, has he got another?
Yes.
She got another
one? No, that's good.
Has she got another one?
No.
Then what is left? I don't give any opinions on the place of other writers. I mean, I saw him write Dylan Thomas. It was obviously very good, but I'm not going to attempt to assess, nor do I intend to give any opinion on the war in Vietnam, which none of us like, but we don't know what to do about it. This is, I think, a good question. In what manner do you think it legitimate to translate from an artist's work whose language the translator does not know, having done this on two occasions? I can only say what you have to, when you, if you do it at all, I've done it from Swedish, which I didn't, and I've done it from Russian. You cannot, of course, do it by yourself. You've got to have somebody who knows both languages, who is humble enough to give you a really literal word-by-word translation of what you have to do. Then also, if it's poetry, you know, I can give you a metrical model, the original. If possible, get hold of a tape recording of the person reciting. And then one has to set to... And also humble enough not to try and do one's own job of turning into English. I've been in the case of Swedish, with Professor Leif Schoberg, and in the case of translating Kwasniewski with Mr. Max Hayward, I had extraordinary luck, and I really didn't feel that there was any worry about this. It is, of course, a strange thing to do. I think it is possible. The last question I'm asked is to do with the following question. Yeats said that of all Eliot's poetry, only a few lines sang within the sacred wood when Agamemnon cried aloud and let their liquid siftings fall, the stain the stiff is on a shroud. These were the only lines in the great tradition. Well, of course, that is all hooey. What Yeats meant, they were the only lines that sounded like him.
Well, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the evening. Thank you.